Kelly Blanchard for Mr. Jackson. The reason the court should reverse this case is there are three issues. The 404B issue, the position of trust issue, and the failure of the trial courts to really investigate this ineffective assistance of counsel issue. The 404B issue is about a young woman who's 15 years old and can testify to what happened to her in the charges in this case, as well as what happened to her when she lived in another town, Omaha. She's not a three-year-old who's not found ineffective or incompetent to testify at trial. She's not a person who doesn't know her, the one she's accusing. She's competent, she knows what's going on, and she can testify. And why we need the testimony of these three other 404B witnesses is a question to me, but a question the judge didn't really address, which is the efficacy of the alternate proofs, which are JJ's own testimony and her ability to testify to what happened to her in both these two different, completely separate situations. Further, I submit that the judge didn't really look at the preponderance of the evidence of the proof that these other situations had occurred. The two daughters, as well as the niece, who were the other three complaining or 404B witnesses. The one daughter, SJ, didn't even come forth until the detective more or less dragged it out of her. There were no criminal charges involving SJ, and the BU situation was similar. She didn't even want to talk to the detective until she figured out what happened to her by going to therapy. So the judge really didn't look at those two factors in permitting this 404B evidence. And Kelly's argument that this 404B evidence was shown, was admitted to show that she didn't recently fabricate, but that was never a defense, that she recently fabricated. The defense was, I didn't do it, and she's lying. Nothing about recent fabrication. And also, in the final argument, the DA was using the 404B evidence to, she called it the darkness. You know, it was character evidence that she was using the 404B evidence to argue to the jury.
Didn't the trial court sustain an objection to that description?
Well, yes, but it was said, and that was the thrust of the DA's argument, that this guy was a bad guy because, look, he did this to all these people in his family. And that's certainly a character assassination. And the DA also argued that you have to believe JJ, that she was telling the truth. Not that I need all these other people to show she was telling the truth, that JJ, by her own testimony, was telling the truth.
So would you explain for me your sense of the difference between a defense of fabrication, or she's lying, I didn't do it and she's lying, and this concept of recent fabrication? What is your sense of the difference there?
Well, there's some of the cases make a slight difference there.
Implicit in your argument was that this 404B evidence would not be admissible here to support an inference that she's telling the truth and thereby defeat the argument that she's lying and I didn't do it. But it might be admissible if the defense had been recent fabrication. So I'm just trying to get a handle on when it's one and when it's the other.
Well, defense never argued, well, she said it this way this time, and then she said it this way this time. There was never a difference. Defense never argued. There was never a change.
An inconsistency?
Right.
Right.
An inconsistency in her accusations. Just that...
She's making it all up.
She's making it all up. So there's no recent fabrication. I think it's a small argument. But I saw the cases where there's no argument of recent fabrication. And further, during the trial, the DA was constantly asking other witnesses about what they knew about these allegations by the other 404B witnesses, and there was never a cautionary instruction given. When the actual 404B witnesses were testifying, there's a cautionary instruction. But when the DA said, well, BU, do you know about what happened to SJ? There was no cautionary instruction. So that's an error with the 404B evidence. As the position of trust, mom of JJ, LJ consistently said, I didn't want Mr. Jackson in my house. I didn't want him taking my kids without my knowledge. Or I didn't want him taking my kids when I was at work. I never let him alone with my daughter. If he took them somewhere, they were all three together. And she never charged him. The statute says charged him with the responsibilities of being a parent. And I think, you know, all these cases overlook that word charged. I think it's this position of trust. If I don't have kids, but if I let my kids go with somebody else, I mean, you that's a conscious permitting. But this woman was not consciously permitting this man, her father, to take her children anywhere. And she further said they were always three together if they ever went.
Ms. Blanchard, I wanted to ask you about that because your briefs focus on the issue of the lack of supervision or lack of authority to supervise the victim here, or JJ. But the statute on position of trust also refers to any duty or responsibility for the health, education, or welfare of the child. And wasn't there evidence that at least that Mr. Jackson was buying groceries for the family?
Well, if he brought food to the house, what is it? What is a daughter to do? Take it away? And especially if she's financially stressed and has 300 kids, I don't think that's charging. She didn't ask him to do it. She never said she asked the man to do it. These facts are really tough in that this woman is supposed to tell her father to get out of the house when she feels she doesn't own the house.
So as I understand, you're saying even if he brought food, he did not have any duty or responsibility to do that.
Correct. Out of the kindness of his heart, he brings food. She didn't ask him. She never testified she asked him to.
Well, does the record show that at the time of the charged incidents, Mr. Jackson was alone in the house? He was the only adult in the house with the complaining witness?
If the question is that my interpretation of the facts?
Does the record support that inference?
I think so. I can't recall. It's really, I think, vague or silent on that point because JJ just testified to what happened to her. And there's no testimony that mom was or was not there. Maybe the evening things, the one thing that happened at night, there was a testimony that mom was not in the house. And then the issue of the court failing to look into Mr. Jackson's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. So he was arrested in March. He first raised about 6 months later, September, my attorneys aren't investigating. Nothing was really done. And then, 11 months after his arrest, he's again raising that issue. And the sealed documents, his handwritten letter or whatever, four-page deal to the court, the very last thing says, because my attorneys didn't investigate, I lost my alibi defense. That's because documents were destroyed or something to that effect. And when they had the closed hearing, the judge used the three Berger issues to say, no, you don't have an issue here. He just sort of blew it off and didn't really address the issue.
I confess to being a little confused about this argument, because as I understand the record, this all takes place at time A, well before trial, where your client is seeking different appointed counsel. But later on, when we go to trial, by that point he has hired a private lawyer and he goes to trial with a private lawyer, correct?
Yes, sir.
So what relief could we grant here?
Yes, this is a question. The issue is the court failed to investigate and thus failed to recognize counsel was ineffective by failing to make all the questions needed to find out what this man was really saying when he was presenting his pro se pleadings.
And presumably, if the court had done what you wish the court had done, the court would have recognized that appointed counsel wasn't working out and would have appointed a new lawyer.
Correct.
Okay.
And my client wouldn't have then had to go pro se and then actually hire somebody.
Are you looking for a refund? Is that, looking to get a reimbursement of the money that he had to spend on the lawyer? Is that?
No, sir. No,
okay. Because he had another lawyer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that is definitely a weakness in this argument.
All right.
It is an argument my client wished me to make.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People, bar number 38141. I'd like to begin with the defense's principal argument on the first issue, which is that because the people were allowed to introduce evidence about the defense attack of JJ in Omaha, the evidence regarding the defendant's sexual assaults against his niece and his other two daughters shouldn't have come in. There are two fundamental flaws in that position. One is that the evidence regarding the other sexual assaults was uniquely relevant apart from the Omaha incident. And two, the fact that the defendant committed so many similar crimes so many times, that in itself was independently relevant.
How was that relevant, counsel?
Well, with respect to the first, the fact that the defendant had attacked JJ previously doesn't show what the other evidence showed, which is the fact that the defendant targeted other victims of his family repeatedly. It shows that he has a penchant and proclivity for attacking women in his family.
Why isn't that precisely what's prohibited by 404B?
Because that shows the motive and why he chose the victim, which is this court's cases have held as a proper and permissible inference apart from character. We're not looking at just the fact that he's a bad person, we're going to convict him. It goes to show something independent, which is the route says that permissible. It doesn't matter that there's the possibility of a character inference. There just has to be a relevant, independent purpose beyond the evidence. And here it showed why he might target JJ.
Can you address this concept or this difference between fabrication, attack on the witness's credibility generally, and recent fabrication?
I can't. I'd like to start off first cut with saying, I think in this case, we're not playing with that distinction. It was admitted solely because the defendant had alleged fabrication. The instruction didn't say recent fabrication, it was just fabrication. The defendant's claim all along was the victim is lying completely. So I don't think this case necessarily bears that distinction.
So is it your view that, if the defendant is claiming fabrication generally, and that the evidence is nevertheless admissible for to rebut that attack, even if it's not a recent fabrication?
Yes, and I think this court's cases have said as much. I think Leonard, Larson, especially in the context of 1610.301, the sex assault 404B evidence statute. That section makes clear that unlike other 404B evidence, prior act evidence is more accessible given the nature of sexual assault cases. Precisely because we often get what we have here, where it's one side saying this happened, the other side saying they're lying, and there are no other witnesses to the assault. So as the General Assembly's made clear, this court's cases, Rath, Villa, Duncan, all say, in this particular purpose, that it should be given its most, it has its highest probative value and its least unfair prejudice. And I think in this case, the evidence was properly admitted on that ground.
So when the claim or the defense is simply, I didn't do it, she's making it up, it still has to be relevant for one of those purposes permitted by 404B. Correct? It still has to be relevant. It just doesn't automatically come in because the defendant maintains his innocence. It has to have some bearing on intent or motive or one of those purposes, doesn't it?
It does, and it certainly did here. Here is limited to show intent, motive, common plan, and scheme. And just to go back to that briefly, evidence of the other attacks was certainly relevant to show common plan and scheme. The fact that he attacked JJ just once, of course, that shows common plan if it's the same the second time as it was here. But the more times that the defendant committed that act in that way to different victims, obviously that is probative value beyond just showing one act. It just shows how common the plan was.
What's the plan?
Well, I think in this case, he attacks at every turn females in his family whenever he's given the opportunity. In all three cases, normally they start off with him trying to do it consensually, and when the victims refused, either whether it's the first act, second act, or third act, then it turned to threats and force.
Right, but the fact that he did something the same way different times doesn't mean that's part of a common plan, I guess is my point. What's the overall plan? What's the common plan?
The common plan is that he sexually assaults women in his family.
So his plan is just, I'm going to sexually assault all the women in my family.
It is, and I also think that this one also has the added piece of the fact that he did it in similar ways. And I think this court looks at the Colorado Supreme Court case in Adrian. I think this case is much stronger. I mean, Adrian, he had two sexual assaults done kind of with a similar method, and said that that should have gone plan. I think in that case, the defendant picked up women who were of similar physical appearance on the street, would drive them to a weird kind of back alley, and then try and sexually assault them. Supreme Court said that that was sufficient for common plan, because it kind of shows that he used the same plan in different ways. In this case, we certainly have that, but then we have the added inference of the fact that all the victims were similar. I mean, he attacked not only his daughter, who he took care of, a daughter who he had never taken care of, a niece who we saw recently, and then we have his granddaughter. I think that provides an extra aspect of a common plan that we probably didn't have in Adrian, but yet that was enough.
Are you viewing common plan then as essentially synonymous with modus operandi?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think there's certainly, as with most 404B purposes, a lot of overlap. I think modus operandi sometimes would require a signature that you don't necessarily need for common plan. And I guess modus operandi even always needs some link. I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think the link has to be absolute in common plan. There seems to be some link, and we certainly have that here. But I guess that would be the distinction between the two.
Mr. Lee, in your view, is there any temporal limitation to the admissibility of the 404B evidence here?
Not here, no. I think any issues of remoteness were completely irrelevant given how similar the different crimes were. So, turning to the defendant's argument that the trial court failed to find by preponderance of the evidence, I think McGraw, Garner cases make clear that a court can find it implicitly. Here, it's arguably explicitly. In the trial court's written order on page 101 of volume 1, it expressly stated that in order to admit the evidence, the people had to prove that the acts happened beyond by a preponderance of the evidence. So necessarily, by acknowledging that at the beginning and then finding that the evidence came in, the trial court made that finding. I guess that leaves the third argument, which is that somehow this evidence is prejudicial given that the trial court did not give a living instruction in front of every reference. My memory of the record is the trial court gave the instruction every time the defense requested it. Specifically, they gave the instruction before each one of the principal other act witnesses testified, the two daughters and the niece. That coupled with a written instruction, which had added language, which specifically told the jury not to consider it for defendant's bad character, along with defense counsel's closing argument, I think that's June 25th on page 69, where he goes through the different acts and he talked about it, and that was other transaction evidence, and that the jury was not to consider as principal evidence in this case. The prosecutor also said that in his closing argument on page 58. And in addition to that, I think if you think about the terminology of other transaction evidence, it's not a legal term of art. I think given the way it's described in instructions, the way it's discussed throughout the case, the jury knew what it meant. The other transaction evidence meant the crimes not charged in this case. So taken as a whole, there's no danger of the court's failure to instruct on several of the small instances when the evidence came up. The jury was clear that what was other transaction evidence and how it could be considered and what wasn't. On the second issue, the position of trust counts, the defendant's argument kind of turns on this reading of the statute that in order to be guilty of position of trust, the evidence has to show unequivocally that a parent said, "You can supervise my child." That reading, I think, adds a requirement to the statute that's not there and stops reading the statute too soon, as I think Judge Tomlin's question pointed out. The statute doesn't say that a parent has to charge a defendant with the position of trust. Certainly can. It just says charged. And the second clause of the statute says that a person can take that charge independently or through another. So it doesn't have to be through a parent. It could be independently, and it could be constructive. And I think that's exactly what we have in this case. The evidence showed that the defendant was providing for the family at the time. He was providing groceries for the welfare. He was driving him to school on occasion. He was taking him to the library, took him to restaurants, took him to the zoo. All those things showed a constructive position of trust.
But Mr. Lee, how does that fit into the statutory language that uses the phrase duty or responsibility? The fact that Mr. Jackson did that doesn't necessarily show that he had either a duty or a responsibility to do either of those. If he was just doing those things voluntarily, that suggests that it wasn't either a duty or a responsibility.
I think the statute, and correct me if I'm wrong, it also includes supervision.
Yes, it does.
So I think that doesn't necessarily require someone being charged with a duty. So just someone who is in fact doing these things for the welfare. And especially I think when you think of the context of what is the purpose of the statute. I mean, as Bowman makes clear, the whole point of the position of trust statute is we want to punish those more greatly who have greater access to the child and are in the kind of position where they can possibly convince the child to either lie or conceal or submit to the coercion. And I think from that light, supervision certainly would apply.
But as I look at the statute, the word supervision is also circumscribed by the words duty or responsibility. And Ms. Blanchard's argument here is that JJ's mother consistently said to Mr. Jackson, "I don't want you to be around my children. I don't want you to do anything with them." So how does that fit in with the duty or responsibility language in the statute?
I have two responses to that question. First, I do think that independently, before that clause modifies it, so you don't actually have to be charged. You can independently take on the responsibility. So to go back to what you were originally saying, if you freely take on the responsibility, I think the jury can find you guilty of position of trust. I mean, whether someone tells you or not, it's an issue of whether you're doing those things in fact or not. I think that's the operative question.
Well, the statute does use the word charged. I mean, it says charged with any duty or responsibility for the health, education, welfare, or supervision. So are you reading the word charged with out of the statute?
Well, I think it says independently, so I'm saying I think you can independently charge yourself with. But assuming the court doesn't agree with me on that construction, I think here the evidence still would support under the contrary instruction. And I would disagree with defense counsel that the evidence in this case was unequivocal that the mother did not charge the defendant with responsibility over JJ. Although certainly she said a lot of times she's trying to mitigate her responsibility because what mother wouldn't when this kind of crime happens. We have instances in the record where she flatly says that she did not give the defendant access to JJ.
So does the record support an inference that at the time of the charged incidents, the defendant was the only adult in the house?
I believe it does.
Well then, why isn't he necessarily charged with the duty of responsibility of supervision at that time?
I would agree with you.
Okay.
But that should be enough. In addition to that, I think we have evidence during cross on page 162 on June 23rd, where she says that of course she wouldn't have been alone with JJ from time to time. Because if she hadn't, this wouldn't have happened. And she acknowledged that in cross. So although the record is a little contradictory, given the standard level of sufficiency of the evidence, any evidence is enough. That's firmly enough. So I think the actual evidence that he was alone with JJ during the time of the incidents, the mother's testimony that she did on occasion allow the defendant access and supervision over the daughter, with the constructive evidence that he was in fact in this position, provides ample evidence for the jury's verdict. And on the third issue, I think this court is right. There's no remedy for the relief the defense requests on the request for counsel. Additionally, as we briefed in the brief, I think the trial court didn't make an adequate inquiry at the time. So there's no prejudice and there's also no error. So if the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm the defendant's, to affirm the judgment of the court below. Thank you.
Back to the position of trust issue. If mom goes away, like she did to go get the car or whatever, and she told Mr. Jackson not to be in the house, and when she called back, she said, get out of the house, and then called the girlfriend to go get her daughter, that's evidence Mr. Jackson was not supposed to be alone in the house with her children. And on the incident when she was went away, was out, whatever she was, and the children were in, I believe, in her belief, home alone, if Mr. Jackson just comes and enters and is there, that is not with her permission. I don't know. From her testimony, and further, when the judge cut off the direct question, did you ever charge him with authority of your children, that question was cut off. The judge said, no, you can't answer that question. I think that was error as well. Anyway, I think you've heard enough, and I would request that you would reverse the trial and grant Mr. Jackson a new trial. Stop all this prejudicial 404B evidence and without charge of position of trust going to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. This case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.